out in all the boots. Put them on. We're gonna go get extreme.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Narstool Podcast.
Welcome to the Narstool Podcast. I'm Shannon O'Grady, science nerd, research ranger. We got JMO here, human performance nerd, bike enthusiast, and aspiring ski bum. JMO, how's it going?
It's good, Shannon. How are you doing?
I'm pretty good. Yeah.
Summer's cruising. Feeling good?
Summer's cruising. Temperatures dropped a little bit. I've got a sick kid at home, which has been a bummer, but yeah, we're figuring it out.
Getting sick on summer break sucks.
It does. And he's pretty sick. Yeah, probably sick as he's ever been. So he's a sad little dude.
Well, hopefully he's on the up.
Yeah.
He's a tough dude.
Yep.
He's got your genetics. He'll be fine.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, things are good. Dialing in the training. I stupidly signed up for that century ride in a couple weeks.
Not stupid.
Yeah, it's stupid for me. I'm not an endurance guy, but I like to try.
You've been putting in the miles, yeah.
Yeah, you know, but I'm at that point of the summer where I'm tapering down my strength training to then taper up my mileage and hopefully recover a little bit.
Yeah.
So yeah, we're feeling pretty good. I'm not like most dudes. I actually love leg day. I love squats and deadlifts. So to shelf that for the next couple of weeks is going to be hard.
Yeah, I've been building my back squat and I also really enjoy.
It's awesome.
Yeah. And deadlifts over. I'm short. So that's right. I've always been, I don't know. I wouldn't say I'm good at deadlifting, but of the lifts, that's my lift.
I think that's a good lift to be good at.
Yeah.
Yeah. Deadlifts are awesome. And it kind of got me thinking for today's guest. I was driving down the hill today and going back, all athletes, I think, experience this at one point in their life or another. Like the first time you interact with a professional athlete, you realize they're built different than normal people. I mean, you're a good athlete. I'm a mediocre athlete, but like, okay, set the stage. It's 2002. The Olympics are in Utah and the US ski team is training at our high school. I grew up in Park City. I'm 17 years old and I'm decently built and I'm working out in the gym. And I got to shadow Darren Rolfs, who is a US downhiller. Not the most physically imposing dude. He's maybe 5'8", 5'9" on a good day. Holy shit. It was my eye-opening experience that like this dude is just built different. He was like firing off probably 275 pound power cleans, single leg box jumping like a psycho, putting me into the ground on sprints. And so I, at that point, realized my theory that ski racers are the best athletes in the world. Strong, dynamic, the ability to hold a turn at 60, 70 miles an hour on ice. And the centripetal force is psycho. Mm-hmm. And then you throw in the mental piece of it all of like, if you fuck up, you die or get massively injured.
And cardio, the cardio piece in there as well.
It's probably less. I mean, I think an average downhill is maybe a minute 30.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit different cardio. So maybe I'll reframe my statement and say they're the most talented, like power type athletes in the world.
Yep.
And I know it just got me thinking, have you ever been around an athlete where you're like, holy shit, this person is just different?
I mean, I would say obviously jiu-jitsu, everything. I mean, I've rolled with pro jiu-jitsu athletes and I watch a lot of pro jiu-jitsu matches. And I'll say that like everyone's, you know, couch quarterback, whether you're watching the UFC or watching a jiu-jitsu match, or like they should be doing this or they should have used this move, you know, we're all guilty of it. And then you watch moves that they do and you're like, I could do that. And then you roll with one of them and you quickly, similar to your story, quickly realize that there's like a significant difference between how they move, how they transition, like or even learning new moves, how quickly they learn new moves. Yeah, so I would 100% agree. It's sobering, but also just amazing from a physiological perspective.
Totally, and I love watching, you know, Steve Nyman in recent memory. Obviously, Lindsey Vonn is changing the game.
100%, yeah.
It's just cool to watch them train in the weight room, and I'm really excited for today's guest because he is actually in charge of making sure they're fueled properly for said workouts. We've got Hunter from the US ski team. He is their high performance dietitian. Hunter, welcome to the Narstool.
Thanks for having me. Super excited to talk with you guys.
Yeah. Hunter, I would love to know, I mean, I'm sure you realized this early on, but the registered dietitian space is like dominated by females. So I know of many male dietitians, but don't run into them too often. Can you tell us a little bit about what got you interested in nutrition early on and then led you down the path to becoming a registered dietitian?
Totally. So, I mean, yeah, to your point, I think I was one of two males like throughout my undergrad classes plus grad school. I mean, yeah, completely dominated by females. So yeah, that was always a bit intimidating to like have to deal with that too. But I would say it all started in similar to Jason, like you talked about in high school, as someone who's also not physically imposing in stature, being like 5'7", looking for ways to just get better in sports, the things that I love doing in baseball and football and those things. So like obviously the first thing that comes naturally is strength and condition. Like you get in the weight room, then it's like, how can I continue to elevate my game compared to what others are doing? And then you get, you know, as I was growing up, YouTube was getting really popular. So like you start watching YouTube videos and like all these things, like, okay, cool, these guys are doing special things around their workout in terms of nutrition to help make it more efficacious or efficacy wise and all those things. And so that's what really started getting my brain going. I ended up going to undergrad at the University of Wyoming and studying kinesiology, thinking I was going to go SNC or athletic training or something along those lines. I was interning with a football team at the university. And during that time, like, you know, as an athletic trainer intern, you're doing a lot of water bottle carrying and filling up and all those various different things. And so during that, you always have some gummies in your backpack. And like that kept that wheel turning in the back of my head at the end of undergrad, just to fill some of those special elective classes. Took nutrition courses, and that's like, yeah, this is it. So ended up taking a year off in between undergrad and grad school, took some like OCHEM and some of those non-fun courses. Oh. I know. And then went to grad school. So that's what really got the things going. I think at the baseline was just in high school, like, how can I use this for myself? And then how can I be nerdy and share it with everyone else now?
I'm curious, like, maybe having your early introduction to nutrition be via YouTube and fueling around lifting versus like diving into nutrition track in college. Were there any like aha moments where you're like, that might have been a little early misinformation or anything that like was a paradigm shift for you?
I mean, I think it's still out there, but just the protein, like obviously it's so important to get enough in as an athlete who's trying to build muscle and recover day to day, but no one talks about how many carbs you need. Like, yeah, how do I actually feel good during my workout, recover like that soreness afterwards? Obviously there's the protein component, but just day to day, like how do I wake up on Friday after a week of lifting and roll out of bed and feel like I can still go after it one more time before the weekend? And that part took me until probably grad school to like really figure out how I can be the most efficient at recovering.
Yeah, I'm really hoping that we're getting into a phase. I mean, Jason and I talk about this all the time, but where carbs aren't the bad guy anymore, because I feel like we've been in that phase for way too long.
Absolutely, I agree.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, I think it's interesting. A lot of people in academia start out with kind of some self-serving interests, right? Like you're an athlete and you're like, okay, how can I get better at being an athlete when I'm not huge and big and strong? And so learning the science of, you know, proper strength conditioning and proper dietitian. What, just out of curiosity, what sports did you play growing up?
Baseball was like the main sport. Played football, a little bit of track, and a little bit of basketball. But after my freshman year, realizing I wasn't going to grow to be 6 foot or above, I was like, okay, basketball might not be it. So some of the other things like track to support my other sports, but baseball was the main one. Football followed that. So
cool.
Those two, yeah.
Awesome.
And then at that point, like also, I also always love to hear how nutrition education, especially for younger athletes, has evolved. Were you getting any nutrition tips or suggestions for how to eat for performance from coaches or athletic trainers that you were around at that point?
In high school, no. I mean, I can remember there was a fridge outside of our like weight room in high school that had, you guys know Trumu, the chocolate milk brand? It was stocked with Trumus, and basically our strength coaches would say, just go grab a chocolate milk on the way out. And that's basically the extent of what I had outside of maybe generic health class information. So nothing specific for fueling for an athlete or anything like that.
I mean, that's not the worst thing. Some good carbs, some protein, tastes good. Yeah,
exactly. Some fluids.
Yep.
Easily approachable on the way out of the weight room.
Yeah.
So you're in grad school. Was there any specific topic or lane within nutrition that really sparked your interest that you know were fired up to dive into?
Yeah. So within the lab, I was working under Dr. Mary Miles. She does a lot of metabolic health at Montana State up in Bozeman. And so I parlayed off of her and was looking at zonulin, which is a marker of the intestinal barrier, where basically you can look at tight junctions and how easily things can slip in and out of your digestive tract, basically. And so we were looking at how do these different things change zonulin, and she was looking at different metabolic health markers. And so that's what really my lab was focused in on. There's also a lot of really cool research coming out on like fasting and stuff like that. So I was just doing like a lot of self-experimentation, like you were talking about, like, what does intermittent fasting look like for me? What does Ramadan look like for like myself? But then I was interested in like soccer at that point. So like, how does this open up to the world of soccer and those athletes, and how can we work to incorporate nutrition strategies and whatnot for them during that performance? But that was kind of our lane in metabolic health.
Cool.
Yeah, I mean, fasting gets a bad name a lot of the time, but obviously there are different reasons to fast, and Ramadan is definitely like a reason that I think nutritionists and dietitians should pay attention to, and that a lot of athletes obviously observe. Can you just really quickly take us through maybe some of your findings for any athletes that might observe Ramadan and be fasting for a large portion of the day, what it might look like to fuel and maybe recover in the time when you can consume food and liquid?
Absolutely. So the main thing that we found is like in any time-restricted period of eating window, whether it's 16 hours that you're eating like normal intermittent fasting, if it's Ramadan, by shortening that window, it's just going to be harder to get enough calories. And in general, it's hard to squeeze everything into a tighter window. It's harder to feel your hunger cues, like I want to eat, like it's time for lunch and I'm hungry and I can actually feel it. It's like having to put in the place. Maybe you're obviously going to be hungry right when the window starts because you haven't eaten yet. But during the middle, like making sure you have a plan that I know I'm going to eat at this time, even if I'm not hungry, because it's just part of what I need to do to prime myself for performance. So there's that part where you just have to have that strategy in place. I'm going to do it whether I'm hungry or not. But then, yeah, revisiting those conversations after maybe that month long of Ramadan or the test trial of intermittent fasting or whatever, and making sure, I think there are some good things that come out of it, like really listening in and diving into your hunger cues, like something that a lot of people, especially in America, don't probably even think about or notice all the time. And so even using that as just educational resource and experimenting on yourself, if it's an appropriate time to do intermittent fasting or if it's the month of Ramadan or whatever the case is. So that was the hardest thing, just calorie intake.
Yeah, I love to hear you talk about that because it's something I've thought about a lot. Like I am a snacker, and often I'm snacking just because I like the way something tastes, not because I'm necessarily hungry. But revisiting like when I actually am hungry and how much I consume at that point, and when those cues come on naturally versus like my own desire just to have a tasty snack in the middle of the day is often like eye-opening. And I think a lot of people leaning into that a little bit, and that gets, I feel like, to the intuitive eating strategy, which for me seems like one of the more healthy ways to go about revamping your diet if that's something you're looking to do. So it's cool to hear you talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I agree.
Awesome. So you are currently working with the US ski and snowboard team, but you've worked across MLB, NCAA, and MLS. Can you talk a little bit about your experience in each of those spaces and kind of how it shaped how you work as a dietitian with professional athletes now?
Yeah, so each very unique and complex in its own way. And starting with baseball, just my last job before coming here to US ski and snowboard, working with a team that's traveling all over the U.S. to various different cities through four different time zones on a road trip. If you're gone for a three-team series, you're gone for 10 or 12 days or whatever it ends up being. You get 3 days off a month typically for an off day, and it's after a long away trip where you're just exhausted anyways. And so for me, that was a big component of just making sure organization-wise, and like we're making sure that the food service on the road is somewhat replicable to what they want at home. And so it feels like even when you are away, you still have some of those homey things that make you feel like it's a normal day at the office, and you're not, you know, 12 or 2,000 miles away from your family in Miami compared to Seattle or whatever the case is. And so that and in MLB and MLS, working with athletes who aren't primarily English-based speaking. And so being able to like bridge that barrier through other teammates or staff members or starting to learn their language through small little bits and pieces you pick up in the locker room or after practice or out there talking with them and building that rapport. But I think in all of them, just like how much and how far that rapport goes first, and like, you know, making sure that they know that you're there showing up every single day for them and they're willing to come out of their way eventually, whether that's days or months or years down the road, at some point when something does arise, like you're there and you've been consistent with them. So
can you speak to how much you work with like an individual athlete on a team versus making recommendations for the team as a whole?
Yeah. So I would say everything I do starts as a whole, because if I'm going to work individually with anyone, I need to make sure that what I'm recommending is actually available for them to do. So the first thing that we do, like here in Park State at our facility at the Center of Excellence, meal plan with our chef, head chef Steve. Every week we go through what our meal plan looks like. And then from there, my individual recommendations can build off of like, okay, this athlete, you know, this is how we're going to prime you for going into this workout or this training block for the next 4 weeks. This is what your plate should be looking like when you're going through the buffet line. And so, yeah, first priority for me is just make sure that food is available. They're going to eat if it's available. There's no barriers, obstacles out there. And then second, coming up on that education piece, like how do we make sure they know what they're doing and why they're fueling the way that they are?
I'm curious, on the Major League Baseball side, you're dealing with typically very young men who have a lot of money, who are world-class athletes, and things kind of come naturally to them in a lot of ways. Did you ever have a hard time getting buy-in from them for proper nutrition? Or, I mean, are they just firing off Skittles and Uncrustables in the dugout? Like, did you ever have a hard time getting them to understand, especially when they're 18, 19, 20 years old, the importance of fueling properly?
Absolutely. And I think one thing in baseball, like to your point, they do have a lot of money at a young age. And if someone was signed at 20 and they got a $5 million signing bonus, that's where I was kind of was talking about, was like that rapport. If you don't have that rapport first, then you say maybe a suggestion, they're like, yeah, whatever. Like, they're not going to take you seriously. They have enough money that they probably have someone on their side who's also giving them some information. So first, making sure that they trust you and like you're just a friend. So for me, like that first couple months is just hanging out with them, figuring out who they are, listening to what they do, how they do it, why they do it, the things about them culturally that they grew up that they enjoy doing and why they do it. Cause yeah, I agree. It's totally hard. And sometimes it's like, yeah, let's have the Skittles in the dugout, but let's make sure we're doing this afterwards. And so finding that give and take a little bit, that we make sure that they know that, like, you know, I'm willing to listen to you if you're willing to listen to me a little bit, and we can make this work together.
I'm curious how often misinformation might come into that. Like, obviously there's a lot of misinformation in nutrition out in the world now. Social media puts it in your face. And athletes in particular, whether it's something, a habit they might have or something culturally they grew up with or something that might even be from a religion, they're coming to you with this whole variety of nutritional beliefs. But part of that might also be some misinformation from the interwebs. So how often are you trying to educate athletes or maybe make them reconsider beliefs they had previously that weren't exactly accurate?
I think that's my primary job. Yeah. Like in my role, I think that's mostly what I'm doing. That's the pro and con, the TikTok and Instagram reels, is it gets the wheel churning in their head so much that it's great because they have all these questions, but it's not always coming from the right source. So for me, I love hanging out with the strength and conditioning coaches, the PTs or the ATs, if they're doing rehab in our gym, and just being a part of that 30-minute hour session where there's that informal conversation where they can just be like, I saw this on TikTok about caffeine or whatever it is. And we can just, you know, debunk it right there. We've been doing a few developmental group education sessions this summertime with some of our athletes who are 14 to 18 years old. And they come into Park City for like a week long camp, whether it's aerials or moguls or whatever. And we've been playing Jeopardy, which they've loved.
Oh, that's fun.
But one of our categories is myth busting. So we go through like five or six different things. It's like, okay, this is straight off of TikTok. I literally went on TikTok and was like, what is sports nutrition? First couple of things that came up in topics and pulled them in, and, you know, true or false, what do you think about these things? And just start a conversation. There's really like no answer, but just let them go from there.
So you touched on it briefly. Can you, for the listeners, under the US ski and snowboard umbrella, there are so many disciplines. Mm-hmm. Can you kind of just briefly touch on where they are so we can kind of paint the picture of how broad your responsibilities are and the different types of athletes that you work with, what it actually looks like?
Yeah. So we have 10 different disciplines, not breaking apart. Like alpine skiing has slalom, GS, super G, downhill. And then you have moguls, aerials, cross country, snowboard and free skis, pipe and slope style. You have Nordic combine, which is a combination of ski jumping and cross country. You have just ski jumping. And is there any, I might have missed one, but is there anything like,
what's the one where you shoot and
biathlon is not under us. They're their own. Yeah.
Robin Williams used to call it Norwegian drive-by.
I was always, when I was introduced to that sport, like watching it, just the precision that they have to have after working their asses off and their, you know, heart rate being so high, it was just really an interesting sport to me. But anyways, we're on a tangent. That is crazy. Like, I never really thought about, because obviously on a baseball team, you have people that play different positions. You have hitters, you have, you know, fielders, you have pitchers. Their needs might be, you know, variable. But I never really thought about how variable the athletes are under the U.S. ski and snowboard team.
Yeah, and there's just so many different complexities, like you were talking about earlier, like the power component of alpine skiing, the technical components of other sports like aerials. A lot of them are previous gymnasts that, you know, have learned to move their body and ski. In ski jumping, there's some weight component to it. So based off of ski length, they weirdly enough still use BMI, which I'm not the biggest fan of them using, but based off that ski length, you can push basically down to 18.5 BMI. So whatever that weight is, it's really hard to kind of have that conversation with a lot of our athletes because it's not always the healthiest, but they know through some of the research they've done with the various teams that I don't know off the top of my head exactly what it is, but it's like per kilogram, maybe it's 9 meters further you can fly in the air or whatever it is. And so they're like, okay, they look at the placing at the end, you know, if I was 1 kilo less, I could have bumped up to the top three or, you know, whatever. And so that's where it gets really tricky is it's not a weigh-in sport, but there is a component that's really hard. And unlike like MMA or wrestling or something, it's not like it's a lead up in 12 weeks where there's one output. It's week after week after week. How do I sustain this? And so we're trying to implement some cool things there where, you know, making sure that everyone's in a healthy space and looking at that first before performance. But
then on the other end of the spectrum for like your downhillers, mass is an advantage.
Absolutely. Yeah. So that's exactly it. Like you have both ends of the spectrum there, like those guys who are trying to get that mass to accelerate faster once you get up to speed. You have everything in between. You have your cross country endurance sports. You have our moguls and aerials and all those different technical sports and the slope and the pipe. So everyone has a little bit different need that they want. And the culture of each team is so different too, in terms of just how the coach is focusing on things. And if nutrition is one of those top priorities or if it's something that's thought about after the fact, and that's some of the things that we're trying to build up, but it takes time.
You've already talked a little bit about how you build rapport with athletes and just through your description of the Jeopardy game. Sounds like education is a big piece of that, which I love. I think you even said like you want them to understand why they're doing the things that they're doing as far as using nutrition to support their training and performance goals. Can you talk to us a little bit more about that approach and why you think that that's the best way to work with elite athletes?
Yeah, so for me, I am looking to set them up for their performance, but I'm also looking to set them up for the next 50 years too. So I want them to know in 15 or 20 years, I mean, hopefully they're still skiing, that'd be great. But if they aren't skiing, they know as a parent, like what they should be doing to help fuel their bodies in the workplace or whatever it is that they move on to next. And for me, like we talked about, there's 10 different disciplines. Within that, there's probably 16 to 20 different groups traveling to all different places. I'm only with one of the groups at a time. So there's 15 other groups that are just by themselves, self-sufficient. Obviously, I'm there as a resource for them to reach out to. But if they're in New Zealand, I'm 12 hours behind them or whatever. I'm going to be sleeping if they had a question during the middle part of the day. So for me, that's the best way I can just give them that autonomy to do all the things that are going to make them feel the right way that they want to feel during the performance. So.
Yeah, I love that. As an aging athlete, I appreciate that longevity is one of the things that your longevity in sport is one of the things you're looking to promote and build to. So we talked a little bit about misinformation. What do you feel like the most common misconceptions or myths surrounding nutrition that you hear about from the athletes you work with?
Right now, it's probably the seed oils are bad and sugar is like the enemy, like that.
But honey is okay.
But honey is okay.
Raw honey. Raw honey. Raw.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's for them. It's I always try and tell them, like, there's always finding the moderation. Like, what is sustainable? It's going to be so hard for you to cut that out. And there's no reason to cut it all out. If there's an intention behind what you're doing, and like, even if there isn't, like on the weekend, take your foot off the pedal and let yourself relax and not think about it all the time. And just like that orthorexia, like clean eating out there. Now it's like pulling back. Like we have in our fueling station, we have a stack of Jolly Ranchers by request of some of our athletes. And I love it because it's like, great. It's an easy thing. You can have some oral fixation there. You can go out and have a little carbohydrate. So like, yeah, we're promoting, obviously a lot of the things we do are more primarily focused, on our efforts, but it's great that they are kind of moving that needle a little bit, and it doesn't have to be just honey or honey meat and, you know, fruit or whatever. So,
yeah, the orthorexia, I love that more and more people are talking about it, because I do think like it the clean quote unquote eating gets taken way too far. And in terms of sustainability of any dietary habits you have, like that is a fast track to disordered eating in my mind. So, I love that that's something that you try to incorporate or talk to athletes about.
Our medical director the other day was just asking me, hey, what do you think about nerd ropes before a workout? And I was like, great. Like if you love nerd ropes, throw in right before. If you're going on a long bike ride and you have a second, have a nerd rope. Like if that's what your jam 100%. Is, have it then. That's perfect.
Yeah. I mean, are you still eating Paydays during your bike rides?
Goddamn right. Mid-ride, I'm a big Payday guy. It goes back to like the old school bike. Mountain bike culture before Cliff bars and power bars and all that, like Paydays are the shit. I will die on that hill.
I mean, they have a pretty good, the macros are pretty good for a candy bar. 100% makes
sense.
Heat
resistant and cold resistant, which in our world of skiing and mountain biking that's also crucial.
Yes. Yep. Fully agree. And you kind of poo-pooed Uncrustables a little bit.
I love Uncrustables.
I feel like they fall into that space too. They're pretty temperature resistant.
Yep.
It tastes pretty good. It might be a little high in fat depending on what your sport is, but
yeah, I know. And like a lot of at least with a lot of our baseball contacts, they're trying to phase them out because it's just like empty calories and blood sugar spike and crash. You know, they're trying to get them into a little bit more of a sustained energy source. But as a parent and as somebody who loves peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, like I'm in on Uncrustables.
I love that.
The strawberry ones.
Not a grape guy.
Not a grape guy. Grape sucks.
Good to know.
Yeah. Big strawberry guy. I'm curious if you were to, you have a lot on your plate. You got 10 disciplines. I don't even want to think about how many athletes.
250
Woo! Athletes. Do you have how would you summarize your approach or your style? Like in one or two sentences, like what's your approach to sport nutrition?
I'll give you 5 sentences. That's a lot.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a great question. And I think for me, one, starting like practicing what I preach. Like I love, like I was mentioning earlier, I love hopping in on bench presses and like being active with them and then showing them like, all right, afterwards I'm going to make the smoothie and this is what we're going to do. So like leading firsthand, this is what we should do to optimize performance and just hopping in, having fun with them. I'm always trying to just remind them that like that consistency is what's compounding over time. Sometimes nutrition is hard to like see those physical results like you do in the weight room. It's not like you're getting 5 pounds on the bench press every week and you can see that compounding over time. It's for us, it's like from now into March or April, when you notice your gas tank has a little bit more left in it compared to some of your other competitors, because you've been so consistent on it for the last 6 months going into the season and throughout, that you now can push a little bit harder and you are getting the results that you want when maybe no one else took it quite as seriously. So that's something is just like consistency. It doesn't have to be perfect, but if you're consistent and you have some intention behind the performance aspects and, you know, you don't go into the weight room every day and just do bicep curls. Like there is the intention behind, I mean, yeah, okay, you might, I don't know. I haven't seen you in the gym. But most of our athletes aren't doing that. So they have intention. They have some plan they're following. You should have the same thing with your nutrition. You should be looking at that throughout the day, how you time things, how you periodize like you do with strength and conditioning throughout the year, and just being consistent.
Yeah. With that, I mean, you and I talk a little bit offline, like you kind of have two different worlds. You have your off season, which we're in right now, when you kind of have a captive audience. Most of your athletes are in town training for camps and then they hit the road. Two wildly different things you have to kind of, you know, wrap your head around and dial in your programming for these guys. What does kind of your off season look like? And then my follow-up question was in season, on the road, through Europe, what's that look like?
I mean, right now is the perfect world. It's easy for our athletes. If they're in town, in our facility, they can get PT. They can do athletic development in our gym. We have a whole trampoline section where they can work on tricks and aerial awareness. For snowboarders, they can work out of the gates. We have a half pipe for skateboarding, all those things. We have our nutrition fueling bar, our kitchen where we're providing meals. We have the whole second floor, which is our marketing and business and various different components that help them with sponsorships. And so in the summertime for 4 months of the year, it's perfect. I think if you show up in Park City, you have no real obstacles to really dialing in, doing the things that are perfect for optimizing performance and your career, really. But in the season, that's kind of dives down to working with team managers on the road. Like, are you going? A lot of our teams right now are going down to the Southern Hemisphere, whether it's New Zealand, Chile, Argentina, somewhere they get on snow here soon. And working with them to see, you know, it's the wintertime there. Is there fresh fruits? Is there fresh vegetables? Like, what things are available? Do we need to add some sort of substitute or supplementation that can be down there for that 6 week block where you're there? Do we need to bring a chef? Are athletes going to be too tired to cook for their own if they're in an Airbnb? Are they staying in a hotel where the food's being provided? As someone asked them what the food being provided at the hotel is going to be. And if not, put me in contact with them. Let's talk about it. That's a hard thing too. I think that has helped with in MLS and MLB is like working with that language barriers. I mean, they oftentimes in South America don't speak almost any English. And so being able to communicate through different parties and using, I mean, simple things like Google Translate or whatever are really helpful. But just ultimately coming down to food availability during the wintertime. How do we make sure it's available on the slopes? Are they packing things? Are they staying hydrated? One thing for women is like, if you are really hydrated, maybe you don't want to go into the lodge to go pee during the middle of your session because you're going to miss out on a training run and your team's having to pay for it. You know, for the guys, sometimes they don't care as much. They'll just go right into the woods and go pee or whatever real quick. But that's something that is a consideration to a lot of people is I don't want to miss a training run. So I'm just going to stay up here. I'm not going to really drink water till afterwards. And you're already, you know, for Copper Mountain, our Alpine team, they're sleeping at 10,000 feet, training, whatever that is, 14,000 feet up. So dehydrated already. Fueling, are you bringing things? And so working on just strategies of always having things available. You're never out of things.
That's a great transition to maybe talking about the challenge of altitude changes. Yeah. So beyond, obviously, hydration is key. Is there anything else that you recommend specifically athletes key into?
Yeah, just that, I mean, that increased need for just calories, especially out of the beginning, just until you settle in, your body gets used to. If you're even going to get used to it, if you're even there long enough, our athletes move around so much sometimes right as you get used to it, you're leaving again. So just making sure that you have that consistency, like there's that appetite suppression part of it too when you move to altitude from lower like sea level or whatever, where you're not as hungry too. So putting a plan in the place, like you've hopefully in the summertime, like you're talking about, they've spent time with us. We've built out the habits where every day before I go into my training session, I'm having this bar or I'm having this banana or whatever it is. And so continuing those same exact things onto the slope. And so working on it during training times and just trying to make sure we can continue it and make it as sustainable as possible. It's not trying to do crazy things in the summer and then going into, now I'm in South America and I have absolutely none of this available. So what the heck do I do? So finding, making sure they know where, and that's where I think that comes, that autonomy piece comes in. They hopefully have the knowledge of like, okay, I don't have a banana, but I see an apple and it can do very similar things.
I would imagine the hurdle of life on the road is a big, big hurdle, right? Different parts of the world, different cultures, living out of a hotel room, and making sure they're getting what they need. That's no small task.
No. Yeah. You don't see your family for months. You're in a dark valley in the middle of Europe where you don't ever see the sun. A lot of different things like that. Yeah, the mental side of things is tough too. Well, it's a long season.
And you kind of mentioned that like availability of fresh fruits and vegetables or something may be a case where you look to have a supplement, you know, fill that gap. But are there any other things that you consider in terms of bringing with the team as far as snacks or supplements or things that just could be helpful to have on hand?
Yeah, so especially on travel days, like all the food you get at the airport or if you're in the airplane, likely just high in carbs, very little protein. So trying to make sure on those days that you can be as similar as possible to your usual day. So one, you're not just jet lagged and dehydrated when you get somewhere. that you have like some similarity and your body's just not just all out of whack. And so trying to make sure that they have some plan going into the day, whether it's just saying, hey, you have a layover in New York at JFK. These are some things in the area where you're supposed to get off hypothetically on the gate, you know, check in here. These would be great options. So even just like planning ahead. So it's not, well, I mean, I have 3 minutes. I see McDonald's. I'm going right there. I'm getting, you know, whatever it is. Not that that's always the worst thing, but at least no, some food is better than no food, but just preparing them in advance for those situations. And then protein powders, electrolyte drinks, those are always going with teams and our PT staff who are traveling with them all the time.
And a lot of these competitions are like back to back days. So how do you help them fuel to recover and then turn around and perform quickly?
Yeah, so that starts, I mean, I try and get it to start with, it's all up to them. They're the ones who have to do it. But the days before competition, like the day before, 2 days before, are you priming yourself? Do you know on competition day, are you going to be nervous? Are you going to be able to get enough food in before the competition? If not, what can we do maybe the day before to help fill in some of those gaps in that day, in that morning of meal or whatever the case is? And so making sure we have a plan 2 days out, 1 day out going in, what does that snack look like in between? Do we have something leading up to the competition, whether it's something like a banana or fruit snacks or the nerd rope or whatever it is that's going to give you that last little top off on the gas tank? In between runs, like if you're a slalom racer and you have an hour break between run and you make it to run two, what things are you doing there to help prime you for run two? And then right afterwards, do you have a meal? Is the meal 3 hours after at the hotel? Is it a buffet line at the hotel, or is it a served meal where it's going to be 3 hours long? Do we need to figure out something to kind of bridge the gap in the middle there? So I'd say the recovery process starts hopefully 2 days, 1 day before, and just planning.
I'm also curious, you know, we talked about individual variability between like athletes, either nutritional foundation or eating styles or cultural traditions. Do you do any like blood testing to see where deficiencies might be, or like sweat rate testing to like give specific recommendations around water replacement, or even, you know, for maybe some of your more aerobic athletes, sodium concentration testing? Can you talk to you a little bit how you evaluate specifics in an athlete?
Yeah. So every year we have annual physicals. So they come in for a camp in the summertime and they meet with our head physician, our sports medicine staff, myself, get blood work done, go through the whole physical process. We all review that, give any recommendations back to them. For the fluid sodium, we don't look at it as much unless it's like more individual cases. If we're working on hydration protocols or something like that, if someone's noticing they're significantly dehydrated for long periods of time, we've been messing around a little bit with the Gatorade patches that have come out. We don't have anything more serious in place at the moment. But the hard thing with the patches and our athletes is, in the summertime, it's a little easier because they don't have equipment on. In the wintertime, when they are full head to toe in equipment, how much sweat is able to get into a patch or whatever device is on? Is it messed up? Simple things like just doing pre-post weighings or something like that and figuring out what's the fluid loss, what things have you consumed, and where are some areas for opportunity within.
I'm curious with, you know, Olympics and World Cup protocols, drug testing, What like procedures do you have in place when it comes to supplementation to help your athletes stay clean and not accidentally, you know, fail a drug test or a banned substance or anything along those lines?
Yeah, ideally everything that they have, they're bringing from America that's been NSF certified, and if not NSF, Informed Sport certified. So that way they know it's been third party tested for banned drugs in sport. For any like medications and things like that, there's a website called Global Dro, which like if they're in Europe and say you have a upper respiratory thing coming on, you can go into the pharmacy and be like, okay, this is safe or not safe. And so it's an easy way to check regardless of where you are in the world. And it gets tricky with some of our teams, like the Alpine, especially they're in Europe for 3 or 4 month chunks at a time. A lot of other teams are gone for a month. They come back home. We can reset them with whatever things they need that they're used to from America that can hold them over for that time. But when you're gone for 4 months, you can't carry that much. And there's not always people going between the two places where we can bring things. So that's where it gets a little tough. And how do we make sure we can make it through the whole season? It just depends.
Yeah. Well, in Europe, they have different rules, different things you can buy at a pharmacy or at a drugstore. And you can't do that here. And you would fail a drug test, even though it's an over-the-counter thing.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you have an idea, like, for your athletes specifically, like how often they're tested?
Like biomarkers?
Yeah.
Usually once a year, like for sure everyone's once a year. If there's a need for follow-up, it could be two, could be three, four times a year.
And then drug testing?
Oh, drug testing. It depends. Some athletes have never been tested. Athletes once a year. This year going to the Olympics, we've been notified that there will be increase in tests taken. So they're expected maybe two or three heading into the Olympics.
Wow.
And then it's typically more zoned in, like it's everyone on the podium or everyone in the top tested. Seven is yeah. So if you're outside of that consistently, you might not be in the field of who they're testing all the time.
Yeah, because the banned substances list is lengthy, and it often seems, I mean, I feel like we only hear about it when somebody like pops for a positive test. But some of the things, it's interesting to hear about that website, because some of the things you would never know would then lead to a positive drug test, especially if you're dealing with a sick athlete.
Absolutely. And that's where it gets tricky. And I always mention them. It's like you go to Jamba Juice or the equivalent in Europe or whatever that looks like. And you're like, my goal right now is protein powder to get some protein in. They throw whatever in. It's probably safe, but there's a likelihood somewhere out there that it's not. And so just making sure that you're taking every precaution, especially this year of all the years, like this is really not the one that you want to be worried about those things when you go into a drug test. So
there was a famous baseball player who got popped. Allegedly, it was ringworm medication. It was like a topical ringworm cream, Fernando Tatis. And it was like, I don't know if I fully buy that, but I mean, it checks out. Like a lot of those medications, you know, in Europe or in South America would show up on a drug test and you would get, you know, test positive for performance enhancing drugs.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And then a lot of the things that we give out, I make sure I have like lot numbers. If I can and it's easy, I'll keep a little sample of that lot number just at the bottom. So that way we have something that could be cross-checked. It's hard because you can't really always dial it down, but in the case that something were to happen, at least, you know, you took some extra precautions that could maybe help in the case. So
FYI, just because a lot of folks always think that supplements are not regulated, but manufacturers are required to keep retained samples of every lot for 3 years post-production. So there should also, I think it's awesome that you do that, but the manufacturer should also be able to pull that lot for testing specifically. Obviously, there might be a little interest in not divulging that, but they should, especially if it was relative to a court case or something like that, be required to give those retains up for testing.
That's great to know.
Yeah. So we've definitely talked a little bit about the impact of altitude, and you kind of quickly covered, I think, and often they're compounded, the impact of temperature, especially when it comes to the amount of gear that athletes are wearing. Is there any other considerations as far as nutrition or hydration when an athlete is wearing the type of clothing that they would wear in winter for either anything from cross-country skiing to something like Super G?
Yeah, I mean, it just depends, like you're saying, like depending on the competition and what athletes we're looking at. But generally, it's how can we get the process of being hydrated started earlier in the day? Either for like alpine skiing, for example, at Copper Mountain, sometimes that first training session starts at 6:30 a.m. So it's the middle of November. It's dark. It's cold. It's windy up there. You roll out of bed after 2 weeks of training. You don't feel like doing anything, let alone drinking some water. And so just starting that process, like whether it's me, you know, being there to like, here's little shots of water, just get 4 ounces in or whatever. Like just start that process earlier rather than later. That beginning is setting you up, and it's going to be so hard to make it through this camp feeling the way that you want and productive if you're reactive rather than being proactive. And so I think that just that proactivity of the simple things, like it's a lot of things that I tell them aren't the sexiest things. Like you just have to drink more fluids. I don't care how you do it. We just have to figure out a way to strategically get them in there, or the components of getting more calories in. And so nothing specific that we're doing outside of just availability and making sure that there is that in front of them.
And I mean, with a majority of athletes that I've worked with are more endurance athletes, like the, you know, rule of thumb always is like, you shouldn't try anything new on race day, and anything you should be doing with your nutrition, you should have practiced all along the way. So is that same type of thing where you're taking a lot of the principles you're trying to get them to use on a day when they have a race, and they're using them during the camps to get ready as well, to make sure that one, it's working for them too. They've tried both either the food or type of drink that, you know, you're recommending or that is available to them, but then also the quantity and frequency at which they should be drinking or eating.
Absolutely. Like right now I'm working with a cross country skier and they're trying, you know, they have all these different protocols. They live in the Northeast and it's really hot and humid up there right now and they're just sweating a lot. And so we're working on different things. But then the other week we're talking and during their races, they don't really have, they don't carry belts on them, obviously, because they're trying to just focus in on performance. So what they do is on those longer cross country races on like a 50K, there's a coach somewhere. They give you a bottle. It has a little bit of fluid in there mixed with a gel typically, and they just like shoot it back. It's like, okay, well, do you do this at all outside of that? And it's like, no, not really. And so they're going down to New Zealand for a camp. They're doing a not quite as long as a 50K, but I think it was a 40 or something K. And so they're going to practice some of these things in training leading up to it. And like just on that one day, this is exactly how I'm going to do it when I am in that 50K. So I think to your point, exactly. Like how can we make it as replicable as possible? Start doing it in the gym as you do it in the summertime, then move it over to your preseason camp. If it works, then great. If not, let's figure out some time that we can manipulate it a bit and find what does work until you're in that those actual competition races and stuff. And you just know what to do. It's second nature and your body is like, this is usual.
Yeah.
I'm not having to do anything weird.
In ultra running lately, it's been cool to see, once again, a re-emphasis on the importance of carbs, but also people pushing the total amount of carbs that you can take in an hourly rate. I don't know enough about cross-country skiing beyond those athletes are amazing, but as far as like the longer races, whether or not they're really looking to push the limits of carb intake, is that something that has started trickling into that sport as well? And is it relevant, or are the length of the races just aren't long enough?
It's not like the Tour de France stuff that, like, especially like this time of year after with all that going on, all those things come out and they're pushing like 130 grams an hour. And it's crazy to even think about doing that every day for what, 21 stages and the days in between. But for cross country skiers, like the 50K still isn't really long enough to have to push like that maximum.
How long does a 50K take for cross country?
It depends, but not more than like a couple hours.
Oh, okay.
So it's still, I mean, yeah, a long time for us mere mortals, yeah. But like for them, it's like, they can make it through if they have like those gels and things, at least to the end of that with proper attention on the front side of things going into it. So yeah, not having to push it as hard as like the Tour de France.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cause yeah, I was just reading an article on that the other day. I was like, I can't imagine doing that.
That's insane. Yeah. I mean, there's this ultra runner, David Roche, who just broke. I always get it confused which ultra it was, but I think it was Western States record held for 12 years. I don't even remember, like some absurd amount or absurd time per mile. But one of the things he credits to his ability to break that record and run as fast as he did is the intake of more calories than had been thought the body could tolerate. And his wife is, I think she has her PhD in exercise physiology, and he gives her a lot of credit for really looking into what was possible. But one of the coolest things I thought is they studied professional eaters. So folks that do like eating competitions, to look at techniques they use to be able to take in more food than they would otherwise be able to consume without being sick. And I thought that was nuts. But it's also good to see that we are recovering from our carb shaming years and really leaning into the fact that for so many sports, carb is king.
Carb is king. That's the truth.
Yeah.
I'm kind of curious, going back to jumping in, doing bench presses with the guys, what's the relationship like with the other coaches? So the medical directors, the orthopedic surgeons, PTs, ATCs, strength coaches, what are the kind of the inner workings of the medical team, and how do you guys all work together?
Yeah, so we have, it's all under our high performance department. So we're all technically under that umbrella within US Ski and Snowboard. We have our medical, strength and conditioning, sports science, myself, our chef, all the various different components. And so we all work in a big open space with it, like right off of our weight room. There's 25 of us or whatever in there. And so it's easy to have conversations with one another in between sessions. For me, like I mentioned earlier, hopping in on a S&C session or whatever, like there's a lot of time where we spend with one another, the PTs and S&Cs, as they're crossing over in rehab, they dual sessions sometimes. We have weekly, you know, one or two meetings with the whole crew where we're going over different cases or different education topics and stuff like that. And so there's just a lot of inner workings. And then especially right now when we're all here, once we hit the next, you know, in 2 months from now, it's kind of an island over in Park City when everyone goes out for their preseason camps and it's just no one's left. It's kind of spooky. Earlier in July, we had a couple hundred, like 120 athletes who we were feeding every day. So there's a lot of people coming in plus our staff members. And already now you can start to see trickles. Everyone's kind of going home to see their family for a little bit and then they trickle out in August. And so you're already like, this is weird. There's only
ghost
there's
town.
20 people in here today.
It's a huge building and all of a sudden there's nobody in there.
Yeah.
Another part of the approach of off season, in season, that I'd like to kind of dive into is recovery from injury. So, you know, injury is part of winter sport. So we'll just kind of use the example of like an ACL. One of your athletes pops their ACL, has reconstructive surgery. What role do you think nutrition can play in the recovery process, and how can an athlete optimize their nutrition to speed up their recovery?
So I think like building off of how I was kind of talking about like the recovery components of just a competition, looking at surgery, like if it's an ACL, usually you need to wait for some of the inflammatory process to dive down before you actually go into surgery. So it could be 2-3-4 week block. And so in that 2-3-4 week block, you know, making sure that protein intake and calories are adequate, where you're maintaining as much of that muscle mass as possible on the affected limb, if it's your right leg or whatever. So that way, when you're coming out and the PTs are like, okay, we're trying to get this leg mass up, you know, hopefully you're not in as much of a deficit as possible. For us, like if it's, we have voluntary like body composition all year round. So like if anyone's interested in those things, if not, like I offer it during that period to just like kind of, if we want to get a baseline that we can check in periodically, how do things change? How does your lean muscle mass change? And just like giving them the opportunity, like we're not necessarily looking at anything. It's more so this is information for you if you want to use it, however, and we can kind of help provide you with any educational tools along the way to help. But yeah, I think nutrition massive on the front end, and just maintaining during that beginning phase, like making sure that nutrient availability and all those things on the process of that inflammatory proliferation and stuff at the beginning is there. And then building off of that, as we start out of the PT, you know, weeks in ski and snowboard, we have it built out. It's like, it's called our RTP process. So our return to performance, 7 different stages that if you were in ACL, you start at stage 0 right before pre-op. You move up that line and at each different stage, we kind of have something else that maybe we're focusing on the nutrition side of things as they build in the plyometrics and PT, as they move over to strength and conditioning more so. And the reins are let off on the PT side of things. Like how do we transition more to the competition fueling in the athletic development side of things?
Can you tell us a story time of an athlete you've worked with where a nutritional change has made a huge impact on either their performance or recovery? It could be like the addition of something. It could even be the subtraction of something, but kind of just speak through their experience and how kind of focusing more in on nutrition was helpful.
Yeah, so one story that comes first to mind, working with a cross-country skier, they noticed that they were burping frequently throughout the day, but then more so during the end of their endurance sessions, like just constantly like feeling like it was almost impeding performance, like they couldn't breathe normally because they were having to burp. And so diving into some different things, I'd seen gastro docs and all those various different things, or wondering, you know, low FODMAP diet, like see if it was something within that or whatever. And so I was kind of like looking around and trying to think like, what else could it be? And thinking about, oh, cross country, you live in the Northeast, it's hot, humid. Are you staying hydrated? Is like, do you have enough blood flow that you're able to, you know, are you going into hydrated during that session? As you become more dehydrated during the session, is it exacerbating those symptoms? And so throughout the course of, it was about 5-6 weeks, we did USG testing. So urine specific gravity testing with a refractometer every single morning. I sent one out to them. They had all the supplies. And so looking and tracking, like how does it correlate from USG, what you are in the morning compared to the severity of your symptoms? So over time, you know, at the beginning, before we were really working on strategies, I was just like, just do it. We won't do anything. Just do what you would normally do. And so the first couple of days, you notice, like, you know, if you're thinking colors, they're in that like darker yellow kind of urine color. It's more moderately dehydrated. As we start to implement things the second and third week, you start seeing more of those greens pop up. And it's like, okay, you're getting more into the hydrated space. As you wake up in the morning, you see severity of symptoms drops down. Instead of, I gave a scale 1, 2, or 3, just make it easy. So instead of 2s, 3s, now you're seeing 1, 2s. As you start to go three weeks in, more ones, occasional twos. And it's funny, then just at the end of that block of time that we were tracking goes into a really high volume time of training. Things start to trend back the other way. The GI distress starts to come back as well. And so it's like simple things like that you don't even think about necessarily. It's just hydration. Like as we talked about earlier, this isn't like some groundbreaking thing that like I magically thought of. It's just drink more water. Your mom probably told you that right when you started cross country. And I'm just reiterating what she said. So yeah, simple things like that I think are really cool. And it's fun too when you find an athlete who's geeky enough to dive into research like that, because that's not often that you're going to find someone who's willing to do that for that long.
That's wild. So dehydration was leading to an increase of burping.
Yeah. I mean, so like during exercise, your blood flow is already getting redirected from your GI system to your muscles and brain and stuff. And so even harder as you're getting more and more dehydrated, because they were worried about burping going into the session, they didn't hydrate much beforehand because they're like, it's sloshing around. This is definitely got to be what makes it worse. So you're waking up in the morning dehydrated, go into your first session, exacerbate that. Maybe if you started moderately dehydrated, now you're significantly or severely dehydrated. Have a little break in the middle, hopefully rehydrating a little bit. But then you have session number two. And it's like, well, now you're starting even worse off than you were in the morning. So how do you ever catch up until the weekend? You hit the weekend and then, okay, hopefully you're back in a normal spot. And then the next week starts and you're in the same place.
That's really interesting. Anything that pointed, I mean, were you just like, let's see if it's hydration?
She had tried a lot of things on her own already, like caffeine, like was it something with like a GERD or like something with like the issue of the sphincter from your esophagus to your stomach? And it's like, okay, none of those things are really exacerbating. No medications, nothing else. Like you've tried all these different combinations of gels and bars and electrolyte drinks. Nothing else has changed it. So let's just try hydration.
Nice.
Yeah.
Cool problem solving and and data collection to really back it up.
Yeah, it was cool.
We kind of talked earlier, and I feel like this is a good point since we are talking about things that cause gastrointestinal distress. You don't have a shit story yourself, but we talked about metaphorical shit stories. Can you talk through some of the conversations you've had with athletes around things that could lead to said athlete shitting their pants?
Yeah. And now that you bring it up again, I didn't shit myself this time, but I went to Swig for the first time when I moved to Utah. And I don't like usually drink soda like almost ever. And I just don't like it that much. And we were like, all right, me and my partner, we were going to go to a friend was in town. We were going to go try Swig.
I mean, it's kind of a cultural thing.
Totally. And so I go to Swig and I got like some Mountain Dew mixed with coconut syrup or something like that. And I was like, it's pretty good. And then 30 minutes later, I was like, my stomach hurt for, I promise you, 2 or 3 days. And I was like, I'm not going back there again. I'm scarred. But yeah, that was side note. And then, yeah, on athletes right now, on the Alpine team, we've been talking about, like, we use beta-alanine, and especially, like, for that latter half of the race when that lactate buildup is occurring, they're trying to hold on to all those forces around turns and those legs are getting heavy. Like, what things can we do to just help them push a little bit longer? And for the safety side of things, too, can you hold on if things don't go right around a corner? Can you save it so you're not crashing, injury-wise? So then another conversation that we have with them is like the sodium bicarbonate. Like, are there points of the training year where we can try it out during those longer anaerobic interval sessions that you're doing on the bike during the summertime? Can we see if it works during those testing metrics when coaches are already doing lactate measures in the preseason as well? But yeah, there's been components that are like, yeah, we've tried that. And yeah, that wasn't the best idea.
Yeah, I mean, there's good research that sodium bicarb can help as like a buffer to hydrogen ion production from anaerobic activities, but like the dosing is, well, I mean, it's kind of the same thing with beta-alanine and like the effective dose of beta-alanine. There's no way like an average human can handle that kind of skin itchiness. But the cool thing about beta-alanine is it builds up over time. So like using it similar to creatine consistently, you can get that benefit and you can divide doses throughout the course of the day. But yeah. Sodium bicarb, it's a hard one. And Martin came out with that like fancy measuring protocol, which in some ways I think is great because it helps reduce the likelihood of GI issues, but also is really expensive. So like, what do you guys use, a specific product, or you just try to be very focused on dose with the athletes and just use kind of straight up baking soda?
No, not straight up baking soda. There's a few different products that we've tried and nothing has really stuck. And side note too, like if you're trying it inside on a bike, don't wear the bibs. It's harder to get the bibs off.
I mean, we could have a whole episode on bibs and shit stories, I think.
Don't wear the bibs. That's maybe not the best time.
PSA, no bibs.
But yeah, we no product specifically, and it's more so test trialing within like doing our own research if this is even helpful or not. And if it's, you know, in the case of there is, you know, science shows like it could be helpful here, but is there the detriments to just how your stomach feels? Yeah. Are you getting calories in still? Are you recovering well? Do you feel okay mentally and all those various components as well?
I was just listening to a podcast the other day that it was just like looking into whether, you know, all the research around ketones and whether or not they actually do anything, which is questionable. They may do a few things, but definitely not as much as you see as far as marketing claims. But I guess they're starting to look into the combination of ketone esters and sodium bicarb, because ketone esters can be acidic. And I guess they're looking at the buffering capacity of sodium bicarb for that. But to me, that sounds like a recipe for shitting your pants.
Yeah, I would agree.
And potentially puking at the same time.
Hopefully no bibs.
No bibs. And I'm not test trialing that, that's for sure.
Yeah.
I'm curious, across sport, we're seeing the ages come down for like world-class athletes. So baseball, tennis, hockey, skiing, skateboarding, like kids are showing up onto the scene as teenagers and dominating.
Not even as teenagers, dude. Like skateboarding, you have like 9-year-olds pulling off like multiple 900s.
Yeah, I met that kid.
Nuts.
Kid is teeny. So like it's no longer the peak athlete, 25, 26, 27 years old. They're like, we'll just for easy math say they're teenagers, 18. What are some of the hurdles you work with as you're getting kids into your program at 14, 15, 16 years old? Some of the things you have to kind of navigate with literally a child and helping them understand some of the importance of nutrition.
Yeah, so we have athletes from 14, and I want to say Nick is 44. So we I want to say there's about a 30 age.
Yay, old people.
So there's a chance for us?
Yeah, for sure.
Yes.
So
I just want you to plan my nutrition and a chef to cook all my food.
Yeah, I want someone to do it for me too. I think in terms of like how do we start that at the foundational level is just like get the conversation started with, first off, the coach. The coach is essentially the parent for them when they're on the road and they need some sort of supervision in terms of like, okay, at least we're going to get food at this time and making sure that it's allocated in their schedule as well. But at the beginning, like making sure that parents are part of the conversation as well. It's not just, it's going in one ear right out the left. So yeah, making sure everyone's being involved in those conversations as we're, especially in the injury process, like if that's occurring, making sure that everyone knows this is what, kind of what the focus is during this phase of rehab or performance. Like these are the goals with athletic training. This is how we're going to support you through nutrition. And yeah, like I said, foundation, make it informal. Jeopardy, like they love that. They're athletes. Just like, I mean, you guys were probably more competitive than we want to say we are sometimes. And so you put them into a group, like, all right, winner gets free gnarly protein for the week. Like they're like, oh yeah, I'm in. All in.
What is carb loading? I just love. Yeah, I would love to both play and watch.
Yeah, it's great.
That's super fun. What, I mean, on those younger athletes too, like I've given some talks to climbing teams that have a younger age demographic, but often with younger kids, it's also important to connect with the parents. How much of that do you do for those younger athletes?
A lot. So for any athlete that's under 18 through Safe Sport, we have to have another contact. Like if I was going to text you and you were under 18, I would also have to have your parent in there just for safety protocols and making sure that, you know, nothing weird is going on. So usually like within that pool, like you have myself, you, parent, and one of the other members, like maybe athletic trainer or athletic development coach or something like that. So like everyone's kind of involved in that conversation. Maybe the strength coach knows something differently than I know. And so we can have some of that feedback, and the parent can give us some of the feedback, because sometimes the kid doesn't always want to open up as much as the parent. They'll be like, yep, right under the bus. This is what they did today. So it's great to have that conversation, because yeah, it's almost, it's just required. So it makes it easy. It's like, I don't have to worry about if I need to include someone or not. It's just what I'm going to do.
That's great. And I feel like parents can sometimes be the hardest group of folks to work with, just because they come with their own opinions, both in terms of what their kid can and can't do, but also, as we talked about, in specific to nutrition. How much of that is kind of a hurdle, And then what do you do to try to really connect with parents on nutritional changes that might need to occur with their son or daughter?
Yeah, that's so hard because like we've talked about with the rapport, like you're building, it's hard enough to build a rapport with the athlete. And then the parent who's not spending any time with you in the facility or on the training ground, it's like, how do I ever even meet you outside of texting you when we're talking about various different nutrition things? And so for me, it's like we have our, when you're introed onto the team, we have a camp called our rookie camp. So everyone's invited. You come, you bring your parents if you want to bring them, or they have to come. And so then meeting them, making sure they know what my face looks like I'm a normal human. I'm not someone weird robotic that just shoots you a message every now and then. And so just frequency, like if I'm on a competition, standing at the bottom of the corral pin, like where parents are and just having some fun conversation about things in their life that's not necessarily related always to skiing or snowboarding. And so just, I'm a normal person. You're a normal person. We just happen to be supporting the same kiddo up there right now. So just finding a unique pathway that we both kind of align along.
We talked a little bit about beta alanine. We talked about bicarb. Those are supplements that are more kind of lean into performance edges. Like how much of those kind of things do you look at with your team and with the athletes you work with? And then also like in the field of nutrition science, is there anything that you're excited about as far as, you know, beyond like maybe adjustments to macronutrients or being able to take in more carbs, but things that might help push that performance edge?
Yeah, good question. So for supplements in general, we always look at, like we talked about, like the blood work. First, healthy. Are you a healthy human first before just trying to look on peak performance? Because it's that icing on the cake. It's where are anchors before putting all the fluff on top. And so, you know, with our athletes, commonly vitamin D, iron are the two mostly that we see out of range. And so how can we make sure that strategies are in place to help compensate in areas where we know there's just weaknesses in general in terms of where you are, what you're exposed to, and the needs of your body. From there, yeah, what other things are we checking out first? Like calorie intake. From there, like looking at macros, like are you getting your protein intake? Are you timing things appropriately throughout the day to just set yourself up for performance? And icing on the cake, like I mentioned, is the supplements there. And diving into, I mean, generally, like the first thing, like we'll start off on the performance side of things is creatine. And then beta alanine, like you said, is once we go down that rabbit hole, it's pretty nuanced. And you've hopefully dialed in quite a few things before we've gotten to that point. So yeah, I'd say health first. We kind of look at those medical side of things, making sure you're just generally a healthy person, and then go up.
Anything you're watching in the nutrition science that maybe hasn't come to market yet, but you're curious about?
It's on the market. Something I've used in MLB is through a company called Intake Health. There's these hydration monitors. You stick them in urinals. They're working on a side for the females to stick in toilets and working on that apparatus, but they haven't come out with that one yet. They've said that for like the last year, so I'm still waiting. But it basically, like for the urinal, you stick it in at the bottom of a urinal as you go pee. It indicates a color, red, yellow, or green. And then, so you can kind of hydration your test first thing in the morning. You can hydration test yourself throughout the day at various points of time where you don't need a practitioner to be sticking a refractometer into a little pee cup where, you know, that's not my favorite thing to do and I would love not to do, and just have conversation about, hey, I went pee 2 hours ago and I was this color. This is what I did beforehand. This is what I think I should do. What do you think? And so that's cool to just like take the reins off of it, give them some autonomy behind like a lot of those sciencey fun projects where I'm not having to always be involved, but I'm there to have conversation about them. So that's really cool. I really like that technology. Huh,
that is cool. So is it also just measuring specific gravity?
Yep. Yeah, exactly.
And then kind of along those lines, I'm curious your opinion about athletes starting to look at the use of continuous glucose monitors. Obviously, it could lead to places where folks that might already have disordered eating are getting like too nuts about like what causes a spike versus a fall of blood sugar when you're like, well, blood sugar is supposed to spike and fall. It means insulin's working. But in some cases, it also might indicate foods that are better for an athlete to consume, like those Nerd Ropes, before and after to both help give you that, you know, shot of energy beforehand or replenish glycogen after. Have you ever worked with those? And do you have an opinion on the use of them, especially for elite athletes?
I haven't worked with them outside of athletes who I've worked with diabetes. So outside of that, yeah, I don't really have any specific on hands. But for me, I love like just wrapping around like, okay, maybe we don't have the data analysis side of things, but let's just look subjectively. Like, how do you feel when you have the Nerd Rope versus a granola bar versus oats beforehand? Like, whatever it is, let's just think about subjectively how you're feeling. Is it the way that you want to feel when you're doing it? Mm-hmm. And so without that, it's hard because they have so many other things that they're also tracking, that if this is one more thing that's just like stressing them out. I mean, I think there are various points, like if you're a practitioner who has the time to do it, maybe at a camp or whatever, and it's like, okay, it's really no extra stress to an athlete. And anyone who's involved is just voluntarily can do it or opt out of it. I think that's a great way to kind of just open the door to like, this could be something cool, and figure out if it is something that has application to the sport or whatever.
Yeah, I was asked to do it just for data collection, and was like weirdly curious about it just as being like a kind of a nutrition nerd. And I think the biggest thing for me, beyond them telling me that I had really tight blood sugar, was my blood sugar drops to like alarm level lows at night, and tended to coordinate. I'm a perimenopausal female, so like sleep is something is not like always the best for me, but that 2 or 3 a.m. wake up is pretty, happens often if I do get to fall asleep. And it really overlapped very well with that blood sugar bottoming out. And I like randomly a year ago had started, I think it was more with when I would wake up with restless leg, I'd like grab half a banana in the middle of the night, and notice that when I did that, I was able to fall back to sleep much more quickly than if I didn't do that. And so it just created this interesting correlation, like nothing's obviously proven, that potentially that blood sugar drop was what was leading me to wake up, and that half a banana was helping me go back to sleep after. So I'm similar in that, like, I think we can gain a lot of information subjectively, but it was also just really interesting to try out.
Absolutely. That's sweet.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm curious. We touched on it earlier with some of the weight class sports like ski jumping and Nordic skiing. Last week, Shannon and I did a talk with Dana about Red S. Obviously, you're in the nature of high performance athletes. These are still human beings, and they still want to look good. The internet, it can be a savage place. How do you navigate some of the conversations of, you're not eating enough, you, it's okay to put on some body fat to perform at a higher level? Like, that's a nuanced, fairly muddy water thing to deal with, especially with young people. Have you had to do this much? And what are some of your techniques and advice to coaches out there that might have to deal with something like that?
Yeah, absolutely. We've had to deal with these things, and it's hard. Like I mentioned, they're competitors at the top level. If they see there's an advantage, if I drop half a kilo to jump 5 places, they're going to take it, and they're going to find ways to do it, whether you or me want them to do it or not. Like if it's even somewhat in the cards to be able to do, they're going to find a way to do it. And so for me, it's helping them along the way, the best way and consistently and sustainably that we can, like on that path, but also setting realistic expectations and expecting to have hard conversations along that route. Like, I'm going to tell you, like, if you're 75 kilos and you want to drop to 68, but, you know, looking at you, and we've done a body composition to make sure like you're in healthy ranges as well. Like it's not a place that we can even push to. So let's just set conversations like right out of the gate. Like, you know, I think there is some room here that we can maybe make up some ground, but you're pushing it way too far, and it's just not in a space where, you know, where we could even have that conversation. But having someone with who's with them on the ground all the time, like that coach, that technical coach or that PT or that MD or whoever, to also be in that conversation as well. So it's not me saying, hey, you can't go past 72 kilos because that's just body fat mass. You have nothing left to lose. Like, that's the bare minimum. Like, you're already at 10% at that point. Like, there's no way that we're going below that. And then maybe coach is like, yeah, I think he could drop to 68. And it's like, okay, you have that tug of war right there where two sides are poking at the bear differently. And so just making sure everyone's on the same page there. It's not a bunch of people telling him different things. And just expecting to have hard conversations and having that rapport where you can be open with them, they can be open with you. And yeah.
And as we learned from Dana, and she did a great job of kind of explaining REDS, which can be fairly complicated, right? It can be intentional, it can be unintentional, it can be from under eating, it can be from overtraining, or the combination of those two things. for females, like there are more obvious markers than there are for males. Curious if you do any tracking of like menstrual cycle or do any measurements of bone density regular for male and female athletes to try to see if any one of those things could be at play.
Yeah, so we don't have access to like a DEXA machine in our facility. We have access through Intermountain, who's a partner with us, through one. It's a bit harder to get it done. So if there's someone who's had like a stress fracture or multiple stress fractures, we start taking some of that consistent data through that point. For menstrual cycles, it's so hard. And like you said, it's muddy water because of different contraceptives and IUDs and various different things. It's like, okay, right now we're doing... Not me. Tashana is our Tashana Schiller. She's our head of athletic development now, and she's been kind of head spearing this female health initiative within our organization. So, is it last month or 2 months ago? Our head physician just had a conversation on female health and concussions. My intern Julie, who's at the U, she's finishing up her master's. She's putting on a nutrition presentation conversation here in the next month for just that topic. And so, just having more conversation about those things, that like these are things that you could be experiencing. It's not necessarily like we're tracking it, but just as that conversation pops up, maybe it's a teammate who's like, hey, this sounds like reds, or like maybe you aren't getting like what other things are going on here. And so just making sure it's awareness is more than where it has been in the past. Cause it's funny, cause like as someone who does look at those things all the time, or like in articles and stuff, it's like, I feel like everyone knows this. And then you talk to people and it's like, wow, it's surprisingly and alarming, especially in elite athletes, how few people actually are like aware of what symptoms are red S. Like you look at that new diagram, the circle of reds, like with all the colors, it's like it could be
all
sleep.
The symptoms.
It could be anything. Yeah. Have you gotten sick 12 times in the last year? Like, what is it? I don't know. It does make it hard to figure out what exactly is the problem.
Yeah, and I feel like for such a long time, especially because it was the female athlete triad. Both, it was thought to be a problem predominantly in females, so wasn't really looked at as critically in males. But then also, I feel like that was always connected to disordered eating and not necessarily this idea that you're just training so much and you're not necessarily, you don't necessarily have disordered eating patterns, but you're not able to keep up with your body's energetic demands. And I think that's also... a little bit of a hurdle in terms of education.
Absolutely. And like right now in the summertime, even we have, so have you guys been to the Olympic Park, like where the water ramps and stuff are?
Yeah.
In Park City? So we have like athletes who are doing water ramps. We have there's now an airbag up on top of that where slopestyle and half pipe riders are practicing new tricks, and you fly into this airbag, and it's a safe way to kind of practice in the summertime.
It's freaking rad. If people are in the area, you should cruise up to the Olympic Park. It's really freaking cool.
Yeah. You can watch aerials and moguls go into the pool. You can watch everyone else jump onto the airbag. It's sweet. But anyways, like where I was going with that is you have athletes who are going to the airbag doing one or two sessions a day. In the middle, maybe they're coming over to our facility and doing PT in an athletic development session. And they still all have like this itch to do that extreme thing because they're extreme sport athletes. So they go mountain biking. They do something after all of this stuff. It's like you've done... And you've done five things today and you still classify it as a moderate day for you. Like, it wasn't that bad. I was like, if I did that, I would be in the tank for like a week. Like I wouldn't move. It's crazy that like just their ability to persevere through all these different things and their capacity is so high. So just having conversation with like, you need so much fuel and you have to be intentional in between these times. If you're driving over to the facility from the airbag or the water ramps, have a snack. There's a refrigerator over there, which we stock with things like just grab something on the go, even if something small, start there.
Do you do any kind of, I was just thinking through like what that caloric intake would look like for a day. Do you do any kind of modeling of the range that you see across these athletes? And can you let us know like calorically, like how much you typically recommend maybe from someone my size to Jason's size that they take in?
Yeah, I mean, it also depends on sport stature. Like
Alpine
downhill racers are going to be, like you said, they're going to have a bit taller, a bit larger in general compared to like some of our aerialists who are just more petite and aerial awareness and stuff like that. But it could be anywhere from 25 to 5,000 calories. Like and to that point, like I'm not often really recommending like, you know, you should have 2,500 calories. It's more so like we use a lot of like the plates.
Yeah.
Like I'm sure you guys are aware of like just how do we get more calories or less calories in based off of your training status for the day without thinking about it, but without having to be super intentional, like over focused on what that looks like exactly to the gram and stuff.
Yeah, not one other thing that they need to stress about.
Yeah, exactly. But there will be points of time, like if you know they're home for rehab, maybe give me a glimpse of 2 days of what your life look like. Just send me a picture. Like, let's check in as informally as that. You don't have to worry about inputting anything on MyFitnessPal or any other tracker like that. Just send me a picture and then let's have a conversation about what it looked like and when, what you feel like, how you recovered, how the body feels, all those various things.
Something I've noticed over the last, you know, through this conversation is you're really good at getting on these kids' level. Like you're willing to kind of change the way you do things, whether it's text or shoot me a photo of your dinner. Like you seem really like pliable and flexible in how you approach nutrition. I'm curious, how can you, like, do you hang with them on snow? And what, like, do you have any credibility with these guys and girls on snow? Like, or are you just a total kook?
I mean, I
that wasn't very nice, Jason.
I mean, the question, it's two ends of the spectrum.
You come from the baseball space, and I know you, as a softball player, you're good. So you have credibility in that space. How are you on snow? Fair question.
So I was born outside of Philadelphia. So I grew up skiing like a hill.
What hill?
It's called Blue Mountain.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I grew up in Northern Virginia. So Pennsylvania was like the skiing destination.
Yeah. If we got crazy, we'd go to like Jack Frost.
Yeah. Vermont sometimes, yeah. Occasionally once a year, but I get you.
But I moved to Northwest Wyoming, Cody, right outside the East Gate of Yellowstone when I was heading into the eighth grade. So then started skiing some bigger mountains and stuff like that. However, I snowboarded at the time and did for 15 years and just switched to skiing about 3 years ago. And I'm pretty confident in my skills, but then you get on an icy downhill course and you're skidding along. You're like, I'm in a bad spot. So I'm a confident skier, good skier, but not, I mean, their level is so beyond. It's like a Brian Scalabrine. Like, he gets all the grief. And there was a story I might have listened to or heard or something on ESPN or a podcast, but he was like a notorious bench player for his whole career. And then at the end, like, he was retired for a couple of years, 5 years. He went and played like some pickup games against athletic people like us. And just, you know, they didn't score a single point. And it just like shows you how much better even the people who are getting last place on the World Cup are compared to the average Joe at Deer Valley or Park City. Like, they are so much better than you can even believe.
It's not even close.
No.
It's not even close.
No, it's not.
Yeah. All right. Sorry to throw you under the bus there. I was more so curious.
That was an aggressive question.
I'm curious. Like, you spend so much time with these athletes. It's like, can you chop it up on snow with them? I'm just curious.
No.
Sorry, man.
Yeah. They feel bad for me.
We're all kooks.
Yeah.
Well, compared to these athletes, absolutely. Yeah. They're savages.
This has been such a fun conversation, Hunter. And I think like there are a lot of sports dietitians or aspiring sports dietitians that might be listening to this. So do you have any advice for folks that are looking to follow a career path similar to yours, work with elite athletes maybe in the MLB, but then also looking at working with Olympic athletes?
Yeah, reach out to, you know, myself, anyone, if you're in Texas, reach out to someone close by, whether it's a high school or a professional collegiate team. Like, there's always, you always need an extra hand doing something, whether it's like for me, if we were trying to put out some Instagram content or some flyers for athletes heading into an Olympic year, like there's never enough bandwidth for just one person or two people to do it. So just reach out to someone that maybe you're interested in, like how they got there, ask them some questions, ask them if there's any opportunity within that to just lend a hand 5 hours a week if you have some free time. And just like, yeah, build that rapport within the sports nutrition space. It's a pretty small space, as you guys know. Like, there's a lot of similarities. People bop around between different places. But then, yeah, to that too, it doesn't have to be specifically in sports nutrition. Like, I think a lot of like how I build rapport comes from when I was in undergrad, I was a river rafting guide in Cody in between in the summer times to make a little money and also just spend time in the summertime doing something really cool. But you talk to people from all over the world and just like being able to have a conversation. If you were similar to like a server at a restaurant, you can just open up and have a lot of conversation about making how people feel and the way that you make them feel and how you can feel comfortable talking to you. And so things that are hospitality in general are like super effective in being a dietitian or someone who's a practitioner in that realm.
I love that. That's awesome. Great advice.
My final kind of question is going into an Olympic season, who's an athlete people should be watching out for to make some waves?
Oh, that's a tough one. I mean, everyone, right? Everyone on our team. But let's see, specifically, I mean, our women's moguls team in general, I will say maybe is the deepest team with the most athletes at the top of rankings. Whatever four girls make that team, they're all in contention for the podium. That's, I would say, any of those four girls.
Cool.
Very exciting times. Mm-hmm. This is both in terms of geeking out on nutrition, geeking out on high performance athletes. This has been so fun. So Hunter, thanks for joining us. We have a gnarly gift bag for you with some gnarly products. We can also, you know, curate that since you were kind enough to come visit us in our podcast studio. But we also have, are you aware of Summit Tumblers? They're a Park City company, and since you're up there, I wasn't sure.
I'm not.
But they're a partner of ours, and we have these great tumblers branded with the Gnarstool logo. They are great at either keeping heat of the liquid that you're consuming and also keeping your liquids cold on a very hot summer day. That's a positive. They're leak proof, so you can throw it in your bag once you have the top lid on. And then the lid is magnetic, so once you take that off to drink, you can stick it on the bottom of the tumbler and you won't lose it. I am notorious for losing all things all the time. So it's a favorite of both Jason and mine. We've thrown that in there. And then, of course, some Gnarstool merch as a thank you for coming in and speaking with us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I had fun.
Thanks, Hunter. Appreciate you. Gnarstool Podcast.
Something in the science.